Ross Clark, and then Ms. Clary, then Mr. Schimmick. And Mr. Stoker, I see you back there, and you did not want to speak, but we do have a card.
So, yeah.
Oh, did you want to speak?
You.
Ah, okay, gotcha. So maybe after the speaker, if you want to come up and have 2 minutes, okay?
All right. Good afternoon. My name is Ross Clark, C-L-A-R-K, and I'm the director of the Central Coast Wetland Group at the Moss Landing Marine Labs. Thank you very much for this opportunity to present some of our work to you today and discuss how it may be integrated into the ag waiver process. The Central Coast Wetland Group has worked with landowners, local agencies, the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, the California Coastal Commission, and the Regional Board to restore over 150 acres of coastal wetlands and creek habitat in the Salinas Valley.
Our part.
I'm sorry. Slower.
Slow down.
Slow. Sure. Our partners have documented the improvements of water quality and the reduction in nutrient and pollutant loads associated with these projects. Today, I'm here to introduce you to the effort supported by a grant from the Department of Water Resources to integrate the construction of treatment wetlands as a component of agricultural water quality management strategies and provide input from the farmers on the possibilities of using these strategies as a component of their water quality management strategies for on-farm practices. The Greater Monterey County Integrated Regional Water Management Program was established in 2009 to support integrated water resource planning and address multiple water resource objectives of regional stakeholders. In 2005, the Central Coast Wetland Group and Cal State Monterey Bay constructed the Malera Road Treatment Wetland, here in the slide, at the confluence of the Tembladera Slough and the Old Salinas River Channel to evaluate the water quality value of constructed wetlands in unison with on-farm management practices. The results of the study document the nutrient load reductions and the overall water quality improvements provided by the combination of sound farming management practices and constructed wetlands. Dr. Fred Watson at CSUMB calculated that approximately 450 acres of restored creek and wetland within the lower Salinas Valley, in combination with sound field farm practices, would be significant in reducing pollutant loads within the Gabilon watershed to the point where we should see a response in the water quality data collected by the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program. We are using the results of these studies and our relationship with local farmers to identify opportunity sites for the construction of additional treatment wetlands. I provided a handout for one of the an example of one of those projects. To achieve our combined objectives of improving water quality and wetland habitat, we rely on the support of the regulatory agencies to develop policies that highlight the importance of wetland construction and management as a management strategy. Similarly, we rely on the interests of the landowners to provide us access to areas on their properties appropriate for wetland creation. We hope that the end product of the ag waiver process provides the flexibility to adopt watershed-specific strategies that integrate off-site management strategies, including the construction of these treatment wetlands. Through the integrated water management planning process and its funding, we are developing a watershed strategy that supports the construction of treatment wetlands as a component of individual and multiple landowner water quality management strategies within the lower Salinas Valley. We've identified multiple opportunity areas that within the Tembladero and Blanco Drain area, including a 9-acre project that you have a handout for, where treatment wetlands of various designs could be constructed to provide water quality benefits as well as increase the amount of freshwater wetland habitat. Farmers are very enthusiastic and interested integrating this type of off-farm treatment into their programs because it could be very cost-effective, but they need the assurance that such actions will provide a benefit to permit compliance. Before we will be able to implement such strategies, we need to identify the value of this approach as a business strategy. A critical component of an agricultural business plan is the identification of costs and risks of proposed actions, as well as the estimated value of these actions to a business. We've identified some of the costs and benefits for treatment wetland here, including costs and liabilities being the conversion of some of their lands to wetlands, implications of having wetlands on their property, the cost of construction, maintenance, and monitoring, the implementation of these measures, as well as liabilities of other regulatory programs, including threatened and endangered species, 401 permits, et cetera. They have identified numerous benefits to adopting this type of strategy into their farming plans, including priority issue, the superior cost benefit of taking these actions. Many farmers are very interested in spending money to fix the problems and improve water quality instead of additional costs associated with reporting and monitoring. The other benefits are that it, hypothetically, this will reduce overall permit compliance costs. There will be an effective use of opportunity sites on underused portions of their properties. They will be seen as environmental leaders in the industry. There's a collaborative opportunity to partner with neighboring landowners on these projects, and it instills a watershed approach to addressing water quality issues. Key issues to address, though, through this planning process before we can create these types of treatment wetlands include mechanisms to ensure that participating landowners receive sufficient regulatory credit for these actions to offset the costs and liabilities of these unique approaches. We need to identify adaptive management processes for projects that miss interim water quality objectives. We need to identify ways to allocate costs among multiple landowners. We need to establish safe harbor agreements and wetland maintenance plans so that these treatment systems can be maintained over time. We will need to address other food safety concerns, and we will need to integrate these projects with the county flood control programs. All issues that we are prepared to address, and hopefully can use this forum and working with staff to accomplish these. Farmers have raised several issues that I've brought up here, and they must we must work to address them before we can get access to and create these wetlands. But we're very encouraged by their current interest in working with us, to the fact that they have reached out to us to talk about and take us out to opportunity sites on their land. It's an extreme change in the way we have been interacting with farmers in the last few years. If we can minimize the liabilities and make treatment wetlands a cost-effective business strategy for sustainable agriculture, we will be better prepared to meet our region's water quality and wetland management objectives. In conversations with regional board staff, we have been ensured that the current ag waiver process does provide avenues to integrate this type of off-site wetland treatment into the ag permit process, but there are lots of questions outstanding on how that compliance can be achieved and how we can address these other costs and liabilities that the farmers have identified. We hope to work with staff over the next year to identify opportunities to integrate these practices.
Thank you for your comments.
Mr. Jeffries?
Ross, thank you today for coming and, helping us to gain a perspective on the work of the Central Coast Wetlands Project and how you might fit into contributing to the technical solutions we need. So just so I'm clear, your second to the last slide was referring to the IRWIMP planning process. Does that reflect the possibility that IRWIMP monies are going to go into supporting this, or what's the connection to IRWIMP?
We do have plenty planning funds currently through the Greater Monterey IRWIMP to provide technical support design treatment wetlands, identify opportunity sites, and use some of those resources to help address some of these outstanding questions on how these types of wetland projects can be integrated into whatever type of regulatory process is adopted.
Okay, so this is still pilot program level, or is it more of a the ability to go and assess the unique, you know, one size does not fit all kind of approach?
We are going to address that at a sub-watershed level, looking at the lower Salinas Valley, and a significant opportunity place to work, especially since many of the landowners are very interested to work with us.
Okay, good, thanks.
Okay, Mr. Jeffries, did you have?
Well, I had a question, but some of us board members did tour the Malera site a year or so ago and was very interested in it, and it was very productive. My question to you is that it appears to me for this to work, you're going to have to take land out of production. Is that correct in some areas?
In some areas, if we can address the cost-benefit issues, some farmers have said that they would be willing to do that. We have identified many locations where the land is too wet to farm, and it is currently just disc for weed management. We're going to focus primarily on those as part of the pilot project.
My next question, if you can set more of these up in wetlands,
yes.
This will create more of a riparian corridors. How does this work with the food safety issue?
We have funding within the IRWMP to ask that question and utilize some of our partner organizations that are at the forefront of the food safety process to identify the appropriate management strategies to ensure that farmers aren't in some way penalized for having this type of treatment wetland on their sites. We've identified rodent and bunny fences, use of certain types of plants over others, but we are going to work through that process to ensure that the systems we put out will not pose additional food safety liabilities.
Now, are you only looking to do this at the lower Salinas Valley, or are you looking to do throughout Salinas Valley, Santa Maria, and throughout the whole region?
We have funding to do it in the lower Salinas Valley, but we have addressed staff questions that we'd be happy to partner with other areas that want to incorporate these same ideas, and we'll look for opportunity funding or do as much as we can to help move this idea forward throughout the region.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you very much for your opportunity.
Okay, I'm taking two people out of order. Mr. Stoker, these are people that need to leave, and then Ms. Lopez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, honorable members of the board, my name is Mike Stoker, S-T-O-K-E-R. I'm here today representing the United Agribusiness League. The United Agribusiness League is an agricultural association that provides multiple employer benefits. Through its over 1,400 employer members, the league provides health insurance to over 42,000 agricultural employees. On behalf of those employers and employees, the league strongly urges the board to reject staff's recommendation. Fact is that California is grossly overregulated, which impacts were recently documented in the Varzney report. In that report, Professor Varzney, the Dean of Business School for Cal State Sacramento, with empirical data demonstrated how California since 2000 has lost over 4,000 jobs due to overregulation. Regulations that were passed by regulatory agencies like this board, regulations that are not on the books in any other states or any other country, regulations, as the report proves, cost the state over $17 billion in lost revenues last year alone. Today we have another example of a proposed regulation that is not on the books in any other state or any other country, a regulation that will cost agribusiness more money to operate, and a regulation that will cost more jobs to be lost, and a regulation that will cost California to most likely lose more money in revenues. In trying economic times like these, for all California businesses, but especially agribusinesses, the more and more that more and more finds itself on the threshold of not being able to compete in the global market where their foreign competition has very little, if any, of the regulatory burdens our California farmers face, the United Agribusiness League would ask the board to move in a direction to adopt the coalition's agricultural alternative previously presented to this board. The alternative is based on the successful model used to assure food safety. That alternative, while still imposing additional regulatory burdens on agriculture that agriculture in other states will not face, provides a win-win to help this board meet its goals, but also help agriculture meet your goals in a less costly and offensive manner. And finally, I'd just like to point out to the board, I called Senator Strickland after lunch, and I told him, Tony, Congressman Farr and state legislators Alejo, yourself, Blakeslee, and Canella have all recommended the same recommendation and moving force in one form or another, the agricultural the alternative. And Senator Strickland wanted me to communicate to this board, when you have that group of representatives all agreeing on the same thing, which varies, I can't remember a time that you would see that group agreeing on something. That's pretty telling testimony of a perhaps a win-win direction in terms of how to deal with this situation. And I agree with the senator and would urge you to direct staff to try to pursue the agricultural alternative. And I'm completely convinced, as you do, as Congressman Farr said earlier today, you're going to be able to work out those issues. And, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you again for allowing me to go out of time so I could make an obligation in Santa Barbara this evening.
Thank you for your comments.
Okay. Sarah Lopez. Oh, I should have figured we have two Lopezes, right? Sarah Lopez, Preservation, Inc.? Okay. You need to leave early? Today.
Oh, that's a good move. That's a sobering
move. They last till midnight.
Yeah. Do you need to leave today early? That's what I thought this was about. Okay, if you need to leave early, go ahead. You got 2 minutes.
Okay, good afternoon, Chairman Young and members of the board, Mr. Briggs. My name is Sarah Lopez. I'm the Technical Program Manager for Preservation, Inc.
Speak
into the mic. Speak
real loud. Project. Like I don't do.
My name is Sarah Lopez.
Louder.
My name is Sarah Lopez.
Good.
And I'm going to sing a song.
And you've got 1 minute left.
I'm the Technical Program Manager for Preservation, Inc. We manage the Cooperative Monitoring Program on behalf of the agricultural industry. I wanted to talk quickly about one of our cooperative monitoring sites, which is Quail Creek. That's just south of Salinas. It's a tributary to the Salinas River. This monitoring site has shown significant reductions in nitrogen loading to the Salinas River. By significant, I mean that at the beginning of the waiver period, 2005, 6, and 7, the instantaneous nitrogen loads at that monitoring site were 4.2, 12.8, and 5.5 pounds of nitrogen per hour. In 2009, 10, and 11, the nitrogen loads were 0.00, 0.09, and 0.00 pounds of nitrogen per hour. The load reductions are the direct result of actions taken by growers on the watershed to manage their tailwater runoff. These efforts began when Water Board staff began focusing inspections on the watershed. The growers received confidential edge-of-field water quality information from Preservation, Inc. and coordination from the Monterey County Farm Bureau. All involved received an award from the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. Water quality issues in the creek do remain, and this is but one of 50 monitoring sites, but I think it's an example of the Ag Waiver and the Cooperative Monitoring Program doing their jobs. The Water Board staff used CMP data to prioritize inspection. The growers used water quality data to inform agronomic practices, and we had a measurable change at the cooperative monitoring point. I think change will look a little different on every watershed, but I hope to have more data like this to share in the future. Is that all right?
Mr. Jeffries.
Yes. Can you tell me where your monitoring location was? Is it up, far up? Quail Creek, is it below the greenhouses? Where is it located?
It's below the greenhouses. It's where it's just before the creek crosses under Highway 101.
Oh, way down. Okay.
It's not quite at the bottom, but close.
And did you determine the type of nitrates that you had back in the original monitoring?
The the type of nitrate?
Well, because the upper portion of Quail Creek is a large cattle ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Was the nitrates from natural manure, or was it from manufactured fertilizer?
So in the absence of a major storm event, there's no water in Quail Creek except for irrigated agricultural discharges. The discharges start just above Old Stage Road. So up in the portion of the watershed that's the cattle ranch, in the absence of a storm event, there's actually no water.
So your measurement was during a dry period?
We measure once per month. So it's 12. These are 12 measurements per year.
But the Quail Creek does run probably to March, April in a normal rainfall period. Is that correct?
At the beginning of the waiver period, there was flow roughly 12 months a year, beginning in the Old Stage Road area.
Okay.
In more recent years, there are many of the months have no flow at all.
All right. I was more interested where the monitoring was, above the greenhouses, below the greenhouses, but you answered that. Thank you.
It's below the greenhouses.
Okay, thank you for your comments. All right, back to the list I have in front of me. Is it Jennifer Clary, Clean Water Action? Okay. And then the Otter Project and Coast Keeper, I guess that's.
So I'll just wait for my thing to come up. While I'm waiting for my presentation to come up, I'd just like to thank Sarah Lopez for taking care of the microphone. So my name is Jennifer Clary. I am Program Associate at Clean Water Action. I've been working on the Irrigated Ag Program in the Central Valley for several years, but I'm also a member, our organization is also a member of the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, and so they asked us to step in here, and since they don't have staff, we've taken a larger role. And I do want to thank the board and the staff for being so helpful in allowing me time to speak. I'll do my best to take as little time as possible because it's getting very late and I know there's a lot of members of the public. I'd also like to thank the members of the ag community that have met with me and have been very sympathetic and respectful of the communities that I'm trying to represent here. So it's very important to me. So is this my, oh no, I have to figure out how to use this. Oh, cool. So here's the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water, and they've brought people to meeting since 2009, and just to say these are some of the community members we brought. We've got a poor turnout today, and I have to tell you that this has been a very difficult process. I know it's been a very difficult process for everyone, but when you're working on farms, you have to work according to that schedule to come to a meeting. You're not going to get paid. You've already got issues of poverty. This has been very difficult, and I would just say that process is an environmental justice issue as well, and I think that this process has not been kind to some of these communities. Then just to move on from that, just to give you a map that you already may already have, I'm trying to use existing information. Disadvantaged communities in Monterey County, it's a pretty significant chunk of the county. I do want to talk about San Gerardo, because San Gerardo is a fellow member of the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water. And I want to say one of the silver linings about doing this kind of work, there's a lot of problems with it, but you get to meet amazing people and work with them for many years, like Horacio Amezquita, who sent me a bunch of texts today, the most recent of which said, take a deep breath and talk slowly. So, and he also asked the Water Board to please vote for the program today. But I want to stop a minute on this slide, and I'm not an agricultural expert, and I don't pretend to be, but I work on water quality a lot, and I work on drinking water a lot, and the cost to communities a lot. So using San Gerardo as an example, San Gerardo had wells one after another go out of commission. And you know, the first thing you try to do when your well goes out is dig a deeper well, because that's the cheapest alternative. And if you can get clean water, then and you don't have to treat it, you're in good shape. And so San Gerardo tried that in 2001. Their last well went bad. And so until 2006, they didn't have safe drinking water. And they were on the priority list for the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund. They were on the priority list for funding for about 6 years. They were the number one project for years. And somehow, they never got funded. And that's a whole other story. The county very kindly stepped in. And they had to pay $15,000 a month to filter that well water to provide safe drinking water for the community, and I really, really give them kudos for that because a lot of counties couldn't match that cost. So finally, with Prop 84, we were able to get funding to get a new well for San Gerardo. Fortunately, it's 2 miles away, so you have the cost of pumping, and it's a deeper well. And also, you know, the reason why you have groundwater, why almost everyone's on groundwater, is because it's, in a good world, it's cheaper. Surface water, you always have to filter and disinfect. But groundwater, if it's clean, you just pump and you serve it. But the minute something goes wrong, your entire economic model goes out the window because the state comes in, they say, okay, before we give you money, you have to prove you have the capacity to use it, okay? So your budget has to be enough to cover a capital reserve. So for the first time, these communities have to create a capital reserve. They have to, if you add treatment, you're going to have to pay for treatment. If you have a deeper well, you have increased pumping costs. So the costs go up and up and up. And so what I want to point out is you might think that these communities are getting a free ride, but San Gerardo is paying about $120 to $130 a month for their water. The US EPA says that affordable water rate is about 1.5% of median household income. The median household income in San Gerardo is $32,000 a year. And so their affordable water rate is $37.50 a month. So just so you understand the difference between the water, what they should be paying and what they are paying. And what Horacio, but just moving on from that, so that's just what, this is what I know. And so when you sit down with a community and say, who's saying, we can't drink our water, we're paying twice for water, we're paying $35 a month for our tap water and we can't drink it, so we're paying another $35 a month for bottled water and vended water, and that's about what they pay. And then your choice is, okay, for $100 a month, you can have safe drinking water. What, I mean, try sitting down and telling someone that. It really is a very tough conversation. And Horacio wanted me to let you know that it's not just San Gerardo, because they, after all, have safe drinking water, and he specifically mentioned the communities of Chular, San Lucas, and Prunedale. And in fact, if you look at the GAMA database, over the past year, 62 public supply wells in the Central Coast exceeded the nitrate standard. And so this is what Horacio told me in a very short form in a text, which maybe makes for a shorter presentation if we just did the whole thing by text message. But basically, they support the staff. Support the staff recommendation. This slide is a little out of order. I was doing things at 5 in the morning, and I got a little off. But basically, staff has told you the health effects. We know there are a lot of serious health effects to nitrates, and that's why we need to change it. Now, I understand that folks don't want to talk about the report that was released yesterday. And in fact, the good news and the bad news is that we don't have to, because there are plenty of reports over many decades showing that agriculture impacts groundwater. And so I'm referring to one that was published in 1989 by the California Department of Food and Ag that identified several problem areas for nitrates on the Central Coast, that showed that 48% of all monitored wells in the unconfined aquifer of the Salinas Valley exceed the nitrate MCL, and that the 154 wells in Prunedale, 27% exceeded the MCL. So this is nothing new. And one difficulty with this is that there were some recommendations made in 1989, and they didn't go anywhere, all these recommendations for voluntary BMPs. And as far as I know, if something happened, we don't know about it, because since they're voluntary, we don't know about it. And the board chose to adopt a waiver in 2004 with no groundwater, and of course the Central Valley, just to clarify the question you asked Tess, Central Valley doesn't require any groundwater monitoring or remediation at this point. So now it's now 2012. So you adopted a 5-year waiver in 2004 that didn't cover groundwater, and now you've extended it for 3 more years. So you've had 8 years in which you had the opportunity to at least collect information, and that hasn't happened. So now if you start today, it's going to take you 5 years to get anywhere. So while I'm not thrilled with the proposal, I just think you have to start somewhere. And the fact that we figure out another way to push it off just isn't in the best interest of the communities in the Central Coast. More information, the Monterey County Environmental Health Department 2009-2010 sampling found 83 water systems over the limit, that's raw water, 16% of the wells tested. And you know, a lot of these exceedances are in large water systems, so Morro Bay, Salinas, Santa Maria, and so they have the ability to treat their water, so it's an expense, not necessarily a health issue. And so if you look at this, they're looking at small systems with nitrate exceedances, and I think, and you can pretty much see how serious the problem is as you go down the scale. Those are higher and higher nitrate concentrations. So the first one, only the first bar, is meets the legal limit. All the other communities, if you go to the right, don't. So basically what we're asking you is take action now. What we like, some of the things we like about the proposal, and I'm just pulling out a few items, and I honestly am not absolutely certain I took this out of the right order, because there are so many now that I'm starting to have a difficult time keeping track of them. But basically, you have a finding that I agree with, that fertilizer from irrigated agriculture is the largest primary source of nitrate pollution in drinking water wells on the Central Coast. Existing and potential water quality impairment takes on added significance and urgency, my emphasis added, given the impacts on public health. More information on public health. Children are specifically vulnerable, but there are a lot of other health effects that have been uncovered through research. Something that we think is very important is, and you've stated it many times, is the protection of private wells, because a significant population on the Central Coast is reliant on private wells. There's virtually no regulation on them, so many of those people don't know their problems, and that shallow groundwater, which of course is more susceptible to contamination. And one of the things we like about the order, where unfortunately once more I differ from Tess, is the idea of requiring having a replacement water charge inside the order. It just makes things cleaner and easier, and you have less process to go through, because, you know, there's going to be a lot. For all I know, I don't understand how difficult it's going to be to implement that requirement, but having it in there gives you a chance to address the most grievous issues. Groundwater monitoring is another big issue, and what I've already stated, we really need to start getting data, particularly on the shallow aquifer, which is one of which we would think would be the more vulnerable area, and also an area which is more likely to show changes over time. So we strongly agree with the proposal that over the first year, every farm is going to do testing of the irrigation well and any well used for drinking. And I understand that one of your experts told you that that wasn't going to be useful data, but I have to tell you that no data isn't very useful either. So we have concerns, just like the ag folks do. We're concerned that relegating the requirement for nutrient management plans to Tier 3 may not be sufficient. We're concerned, we think that all fertilizer applications should be monitored. We think there should be a requirement that you report fertilizer application just like you report pesticide application. That would allow the board to focus their enforcement efforts, because frankly, it's, you know, I know there's a lot of difficult things about nitrate contamination, but you know, simple math is simple math. If you're applying a lot of fertilizer, you're more likely to be leaching to groundwater, and that's kind of mathematics. Also, the board says only about 100 operations would, as currently apply under Tier 3, and that number could go down under, if you had different cooperative arrangements, developed a sustainability plan. There's limited pesticide requirements, and I'm not clear on the enforcement program. But having said all that, inaction is worse. And the longer you wait, the more problems you'll have. And the Human Right to Water says that every person has a right to a reasonable supply of water for their personal and cultural uses. And I just have to say that the silver lining of your not acting on this program is that I'll get to know a lot more community members, because unfortunately we know that drinking water is going to get worse whatever you do. And if you don't take action, it's going to get worse longer. You're going to have more problems, we're going to have more communities, and we're going to get more organized. So maybe if that's what it takes, that's what it takes, but I hope that we don't have to do that. What I hope is that you'll adopt something today. We can move towards implementation, we can talk about adaptive management, and we can start thinking, moving forward, because it's just, we just can't keep coming here. I did want to, I'm not sure what my time is. I did want to quickly.
11 minutes.
See, I'm doing my best. I hope I didn't breathe quite enough and I talked a little too fast, but don't tell Horacio. I had a chance, and my attorney had a chance to scan the ag alternative, and there are, I had have a few comments on it, but in general, the important thing to remember is this. The idea behind a third-party system, which is something they are currently using and also considering for the long-term orders in the Central Valley, is you don't want them to hide. You don't use them as a barrier between enforcement and the individual grower. They should be a means to assist the grower in complying with the order. And I think the difficulty that I continue to have with the ag proposal is that it reduces monitoring requirements, it reduces reporting requirements, so we'll have less understanding of what's going on. It delays implementation of groundwater monitoring, so you're not going to get that first list of things in 5 years. And I think I had one other, oh yeah, I have a little bit of paper. Then the other, then I have a specific issue with my last slide. So under the idea of meeting water quality objectives and the idea of doing that in 8 or 16 years, I just have a little legal finding that Rose wrote up, and if you'll forgive me, it says an unnecessarily prolonged time schedule for compliance effectively constitutes a de facto change in water quality standards. If that interim period extends beyond what is reasonable and necessary, this effectively authorizes ongoing violation of water quality objectives. The clear force of such a program is to alter the water quality standards in this region. This is an unpublished judgment. At the lower bound, the EPA has interpreted 3 years as a reasonable compliance period. At the upper bound, the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board has interpreted 10 years as a reasonable compliance period in its basin plans. These terms are counted from the date a water quality standard is adopted, however, not from the commencement date of a program implementing those standards, such as the ILRP. Thus, for longstanding water quality objectives, such as that for nitrate, even with a 10-year compliance period, compliance should be immediate. And I didn't have this written out for you because I didn't know you'd have to have it. But if you have any questions about that, my attorney can respond. Okay, I'm open for questions, or we can move on to the next presentation.
Mr. Jeffers.
I agree with you about San Gerardo issues and problems that they've had out there. And, of course, I noticed Camp McCollum, built back in the 40s for World War II. And historically, they've had water problems there throughout. You mentioned Prunedale in your slides there. Are you inferring that the nitrate problem in Prunedale is from chemical fertilizers, or is it from nitrates from septic tanks in the Prunedale area?
Well, as I think I told you at the beginning, I'm a carpetbagger, so I can't tell you specific information about a specific community. I will say it was a community that was specifically listed as being having a problem for nitrates in the 1989 nitrate report. It continues to be in violation of the nitrate standards. I noticed they had a well over the MCL on the most recent report I read.
Well, most of the wells in Prunedale are not meeting the standards, but most of it's to do with septic tanks in that particular area.
Well, you can say that, and I can't prove you wrong in a specific instance, and I'm sure in some cases that is the case. However, overwhelmingly, the problem is due to agriculture, and I think the idea that you keep saying it's septic is disingenuous, and I think that we have septic regulations coming down. I wish they were stronger, but we are going to have septic regulations, and I think what we need to do is not say we're not going to do anything because they have a problem. I think we have to make everything work.
I wasn't questioning whether it should work or not. I was just trying to clarify what you were proposing and to clarify what type of nitrates contamination was in that particular area.
And if you can, I could probably find out if someone has done an analysis of it, but I suspect that they haven't.
Yeah, Monterey County Water Resources Agency has.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm privy to their data.
Okay, any other board questions for Ms. Clary? No? Okay.
Okay,
thank you
very
much.
Much.
I think I've been handed another request. request to speak out of order. Robert Johnson. And then Steve Shemek. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Young, board members. This is Rob Johnson, Assistant General Manager with, it's good timing, Monterey County Water Resources Agency. So to answer the question, a good deal of the data that's been collected in Prunedale has, you know, from environmental health, has been mostly attributed to the septic systems, at least in that area. And that data was also included a lot in some other studies that are, that was like released yesterday that we'll talk about another time.
Can you speak up a little bit, please?
Sure thing. I'm trying to move this close and not knock it over. Yeah. So.
The clock has stopped. I just want to make sure you know that it's 2 minutes. You had 3 minutes on your card.
Oh, yeah, no problem.
Okay.
2 minutes is fine. Your board and our agency have similar mission statements. Both focus on preserving water resources for future and present generations. We at the agency are a bit different, though. We're not regulatory. However, our strength is working with the community, both ag and urban, to find solutions. I understand nitrate in groundwater is not a new issue. Nitrate can take a long time to show up in the water system, so what we're seeing now could be a result of something that's been in the water system for many decades. I agree with Mr. Thomas's slide at the very end. He said that solutions are available. The agency has done a lot of work with nitrates over the years, and in my interest of time, I'm going to rush through to the, basically, when I think about this ag order, I think of the three R's, the old school of reading, writing, and arithmetic. The three R's here would be, number one, to rely. That's to rely on good, unbiased science. Be wary of gross overgeneralizations that can come from comparing and using data that may not be apples to apples, if you will. Also, be careful not to add more to this order than it really should have, or that could impinge on routine flood control activities, for an example, something that would have an unanticipated consequence. So the first is rely. Second is to remember. Remember what has gone on in the past related to nitrate information.
Can you wrap it up?
Yeah, and the third, I'll just wrap it up. The third is to recognize. Recognize the strength, power, and value of collaboration. I'll just stop there.
Thank you very much. Okay. No questions?
Yes. Okay. All right. Thank you for your time.
We're going to take a brief break. Board member needs a break, and I want him to be here to hear everything. So we're going to have to break for 10 minutes.